introduction on background fields in experiments and recent theories. And then we'll do a thought experiment on a bell-type experiment on spin lattices with, I think, a surprising result. We'll use the physics that we learn here to construct a toy model for the real bell experiments, which are dynamic experiments. And then we will go to the main question of the talk. Do we have good indications that these so-called sub-quantum or hidden variable theories can exist? Unfortunately, I cannot prove it to you, but I hope to show that there are compelling arguments for such theories. If we have time, I will sketch a link with some topics in quantum information theory and the quantum Ising Hamiltonian. Background fields. In recent years, Yves Couder from the University of Paris has made a few quite spectacular experiments on macroscopic systems, namely oil droplets, which he creates by basically making an oil film vibrate. So this creates little droplets, and these bounce in the same time they interact with the background fields which they partly influence. And this creates also a walking movement. So actually, they are guided by something you could call a pilot wave, which is the resultant of the external vibration, maybe with a motor, and a stochastic back reaction of the droplet. And strangely enough, this creates several features which really look like quantum features. For instance, two of these droplets, they can lock into a joint movement, and their orbital momentum is quantized. Or you can even simulate tunneling, or they have recently shown that you can also have double slit interference. So when you send enough of these particles on a double slit, the pattern you measure is exactly the same as the one you have in quantum systems, okay? Just for curiosity, are there many people who know about these experiments? Who knows about these? Okay, good. Because it's quite spectacular. And very often people in foundations are not aware of them. Now, there are also a whole bunch, actually, of so-called sub-quantum theories, which have been developed since the 60s. The first one was Nelson and Princeton. But this goes on till people like Cheto de la Peña, Adler, Gerhard Grossing. I've been reading a little bit in detail his model. And actually, even Bohm's theory, we'll come back on that. The common denominator of all these models is that they also posit a stochastic background field or medium, which would impart a Brownian motion to particles and thus explain the quantum behavior. Actually, these theories very often try to derive the two equations from David Bohm's theory, which then itself, of course, is equivalent to the Schrödinger equation. As I said, I looked into some detail into the theory of Gerhard Grossing from Vienna. And for instance, so they claim that they can explain in that way also double slit interference. They call this stochastic background field a zero-point fluctuation. Okay. Now I'm going to present you some results that have been published recently in Foundations of Physics. We're going to do a thought experiment on spin lattices. First of all, we will be concerned now with the stochastic version of Bell's theorem. As you know, the stochastic version of Bell's theorem is concerned or tries to calculate the probability that your spins have a certain value given that there are some hidden variables which acquiring some value. Okay, given the hidden variable, you can predict or the probability of the spins is determined. Actually, that is, I believe now, a much more relaxed version than Bell's original theorem, which demands that the spins are deterministic functions of the hidden variables. This seems to me a very much relaxed condition. Good. Of course, the Bell inequality is this here. A and B are the analyzer angles, and what one calculates in such a stochastic theory is the average product of sigma 1 times sigma 2, which can be written as a function of this joint probability of sigma 1 and sigma 2 given the two analyzer angles. So a whole bunch of people have, after Bell, proven that if you start from the hypothesis of the stochastic hidden variables, from locality and from the hypothesis of measurement independence, this one here, the probability of your hidden variables is independent of the analyzer angles. Well, from this you simply derive the Bell inequality. You know that that one is not valid in experiments, so conclusion is that at least one of these conditions must be false, and the standard interpretation, of course, does not accept the existence of these stochastic hidden variables. People have shown, or it is generally assumed, that these conditions here, they are equivalent to three very simple, nice mathematical conditions of stochastic independence. Okay, they're called outcome independence, parameter independence, and measurement independence. So I've already said what measurement independence is. Well, these are two conditions of stochastic independence. Outcome independence says that the probability of your left spin is independent of the right spin given A, B, and lambda. Now note the extreme generality of this theorem. It says nothing else than that every local physical system in which you can define hidden variables lambda should satisfy OI, PI, and MI, and should therefore satisfy the Bell inequality. It is then tempting to verify whether these conditions are really satisfied in all local systems, especially in highly correlated systems, because in such a very correlated system, you suspect that, well, one of these might not hold, okay? And the physics of such a system could then teach us something about potential physics of an underlying theory, a theory underlying quantum mechanics. So the most, probably the most studied correlated system in statistical mechanics is the Ising lattice. It is still studied by a whole bunch of physicists for phase transitions and other phenomena. Actually, you see the Ising model intervening. I'm here for only 2 hours, and there's already two blackboards where people talk about the Ising model. It is really a very much studied system. And it has, if you look at it, its physics is extraordinarily rich, even if, of course, the equations are very simple. So let us do a Bell-type experiment on an ensemble of such lattices. 10 spins, very simple lattice, all at the same temperature, so in thermal equilibrium with a heat bath at a given temperature. Suppose that Bob, he measures sigma 2 and sigma B, and Alice, sigma 1 and sigma A, with 10 spins that all can take only the value plus 1 and minus 1. So we are looking here actually at the classical Ising system. You could also look at the quantum Ising system, which is equally interesting, I believe. Now, the role in this Bell experiment of the two analyzer angles is taken by sigma A, sigma B, I'll explain. The role of the hidden variables is taken by sigma 3, till sigma 8, so the intermediate spins here. And this is a hidden variable system in the sense that you can calculate the probability of spin 1 given lambda and so on. Okay. The Hamiltonian is the usual Ising Hamiltonian. Yes, but you can also impose it. You can intervene. I'll come back on that. Yeah. Theta here is a 10-spin configuration. So the energy is, of course, a function of that configuration. The HI are local magnetic fields, and JIJ here, that's a very important concept. These are the interaction constants between spin I and J. Of course, there are no direct spin-spin interactions. These are mediated by the Coulomb force if you look at magnetic materials. You can already see here that we actually suppose or impose locality in the system because we only consider interaction between near-neighbor spins, typically first neighbors. Maybe we could include a second neighbor. Here I only included first neighbor interaction. So you can see here that if the JIJ are positive, then the total energy decreases if the spins are aligned. So spin seems to feel whether their neighbors are aligned or not. And this leads to a collective modes such as phase transitions. The probability of a given 10-spin configuration is simply the Boltzmann probability. So let us now do the experiment. Alice can measure the spins on node 1 and A, and Bob on node 2 and B. They don't know what happens in between these nodes. And if I can measure each of these two spins, that's enough actually to determine experimentally these probabilities. Every time when I write P of the probability of a certain parameter, that of course means the probability that a certain parameter assumes a certain value, always plus 1 or minus 1. Okay, so these expressions, they mean always something like this. They could, if they can measure only these two spins each on their side, so measure these probabilities simply by counting relative frequencies, but we can also calculate them. And these are actually the only probabilities needed to verify the Bell inequality, which is given here by this way, by this formula, and where we only need so to calculate here these probabilities here. So these probabilities are easy to calculate. A conditional probability as this one here is of course given by this ratio, which you can write as a ratio of the probability of two M spin configurations. Any probability P eta with eta and M spin configuration is given simply as a sum over all the Boltzmann probabilities, which are 10 spin probabilities, and you have to sum over all these 10 spin configurations which contain eta. Okay, if you, for instance, look at the probability that these four each have the value plus 1, then you need to sum over the 2 to the power 6 Boltzmann probabilities which have these four spins a value plus 1. Okay, there are six spins which are free, so to say. And you sum over all these values. That you can easily do numerically, and that's all what we need to do for the moment. And using the equations that I just gave, you find that the Bell inequality in these thought experiments can be strongly violated for very normal values of all the parameters in your model. Okay? For instance, if you take values in this range here, which are typically values which you can find in the books of people who do simulations on spin lattices, you find that the Bell inequality, or XBI, can reach a value of almost 2.9, which is bigger than 2. Now, the locality of the system can be confirmed by the fact that the Clauser-Horn factorability condition, which is, as you know, the conjunction of OI and PI, is always satisfied. So you always have, for any spin lattice that I looked at, which is small enough to be numerically tractable, and for any parameter value, sorry, for any value of the variables of the system and for any parameter set, this equality is always exactly satisfied, which is actually a little bit, well, it's a bit mysterious because you have there complicated ratios of complicated sums, but they give rise to this equality, which is not surprising if the system is really local and if this factorability condition is really a criterion for locality, as people always assume. So I looked at several of these lattices, small enough to be numerically tractable, and I come always to the same conclusions. It's useful to use measures which have been introduced by Michael Hall in a few recent physical reviews and physical review letters. By the way, I don't know if you know these articles by Michael Hall. They are, I have the feeling, among the best which have been written on the Bell inequalities recently. I can warmly recommend them. What Michael Hall is doing is he simply defines measures for the violation of these three premises of the Bell inequality. Okay? We call them, for obvious reasons, outcome dependence, parameter dependence, and measurement dependence. So for instance, measurement dependence simply measures the degree to which MI, measurement independence, is violated, and in a very straightforward way. You take the supremum over this integral. The integral sums out all the hidden variables, and you look at the supremum, the maximum value, when varying all the analyzer angle values. Okay. Now, as I said, since OI and PI are always exactly satisfied in these systems, you can find, applying these rules, that OD and PD are always exactly zero. Oh yes, one point. Obviously here, the probability distribution in the discrete system here is simply the probability, right? So know that if the Bell inequality is violated, at least one of these conditions, MI, OI, PI, does not hold. Since OI and PI are satisfied, the only one that is left is MI, and indeed, so you can, of course, verify that MI never holds for any value of the system variables, okay? And you can quantify the degree by calculating MD. For instance, with the parameters I gave you above, MD appears to be almost 2, and that means that we are actually close to the maximum degree to which also the Bell inequality is violated with these parameters. Okay? That is nicely backed up by the theory of Michael Hall, who neatly shows that a violation of OI, PI, or MI are really resources to violate the Bell inequality, which is, in the end, quite obvious. Now, this is a subtle but I think very important point, that MI in these systems is violated clearly without superdeterminism or conspiracy. People have always been, I will come back to that, well, I'll tell it now. People always believe that MI is a more or less obvious condition, and one of the arguments they use, besides locality, is a so-called free will argument. They say, well, the probability, well, your lambda are obviously independent of A and B, because if they would not be, then A and B would depend by bias rule, by reciprocity, on lambda, but how could freely chosen parameters, A and B, can be chosen by Alice and Bob in a free way? How could I depend on other variables lambda, which moreover determine the probability of your left and right spin? That is considered to be conspiracy or superdeterminism. Now, I believe that this model showed that it's not true. You can violate MI by simple interactions. I will come back on that. And actually, it seems to have nothing to do with the free will argument, at least not the way I can interpret these results. Let me explain that in a precise way. And now I'll come back to Lucien's question. Actually, Alice and Bob can do two equivalent experiments to determine the probabilities we need. Actually, that's exactly the way it is done also in real Bell experiments. You can either in this real Bell experiment, you can either do a complete run and then select four sub-ensembles corresponding to the four values of your couple AB, or sigma A, sigma B. Or if you can control A and B, you can do four consecutive experiments, as people used to do in the old days. They did four consecutive experiments and then determined the Bell inequality with these. Okay? Now, in our spin lattices, you can do also both experiments. You can, first of all, as you said, Lucien, let the system evolve on itself, by itself, not intervene, and then determine the probabilities by counting relative frequencies. That's basically the way we calculated it. Okay. Now, if there would be extremely brilliant experimenters who can determine or set the value of sigma A and sigma B, I don't think that's already possible with experimental means. Well, then they can do that, and they can do four consecutive experiments. Okay. So each of these four experiments would correspond to a fixed value of sigma A and sigma B. Now, the dynamics of the system remains the same. The system is still described by the Ising-Hamiltonian and the Boltzmann probability. And therefore, the probabilities are identical in both experiments. Actually, you can calculate that in a more detailed manner. This is the slide I already showed you. This is basically the way that's the most natural way to calculate these probabilities if you do not intervene on the system, okay? A typical solid-state physicist is not thinking of intervening on two of these spins. He simply let the system evolve on itself, and then he can calculate what this probability is. Now, if you, for the second experiment, actually, you can do the same calculation. The star simply means that you're going to fix two values of your spins. Okay, this is the experiment where sigma A has a given value. Now, that means that this probability is 1. You're doing the experiment in which you have fixed these values. You evaluate again the partition function, and you see actually that 17 is indeed the same as 15, which I think is not a surprise because the equations governing the system remain the same.
Can I ask
something
more
quickly? Yes.
So the assumption, we're using this Boltzmann probability, yes. That seems to imply an assumption that the system has had time to reach some kind of thermal equilibrium.
Yes.
But that would take time, which means there has to be, the system has to be left alone for long enough that actually there could be a signal sent between the two ends of the experiment. So in some sense, locality is not violated.
As far as I see it, but we can discuss that.
I mean, in an experiment where the settings are made at sort of at light separation from each other, that sort of space-like separation from each other, then that sort of thermal relaxation assumption wouldn't partake, I see.
Well, maybe not, but I think that we can simply assume that these systems are in equilibrium with an external heat bath at a given temperature. And whether then you change one spin in it, I don't think that it changes anything.
In fact, you get the same answer for different commonly equivalent situations. It doesn't mean that if you now consider a situation where momentarily you do not have commonly equivalent, you'll get the same answer, because that's a different kind of calculation.
But why would there not be a thermal equilibrium when you change?
If you change one side, then momentarily you're out of thermal equilibrium. And it'll take a while for the system to relax so that it's back in thermal equilibrium, it seems. Mm. And if your experiment is done quite quickly during that time when it's not in thermal equilibrium, then these probabilities would not be the correct ones.
I don't know whether intervening on the spin, whether that would influence the thermal equilibrium. Don't forget that these are atoms which have their degrees of freedom, which are, in contact with a heat bath, and changing only the spin. I think it can be done adiabatically.
Certainly one can think of examples where changing the spin does alter thermal equilibrium. For example, if you there must exist spin configurations which are out of thermal equilibrium. So if you change to one of those, then you achieve that. Mm. So in many cases, so it's something to be proven that it doesn't affect thermal equilibrium.
Well, I've assumed it here, but we can discuss it. So this might be a local physical system in which the Bell inequality and MI are violated without a superdeterminism. Now, of course, these are static systems. The real Bell experiments are highly dynamic systems where not only the two Bell particles are moving, but also the two analyzers are changed quickly during the flight of the particles. And the real question is, can the physics of these systems teach us something about such dynamic systems? A priori, there seems to be good hope they can, simply because the Ising Hamiltonian is well known to also describe highly dynamic systems like lattice gases or moving atoms. Okay, if you forgot about that, it's well explained in books like Feynman's book on statistical mechanics, or if you want to be really sure, you can check it even on Wikipedia. In any case, the so-called lattice gas Hamiltonian is formally exactly the same as the Ising Hamiltonian, where you have particles which are quickly moving, and you can treat these by also assuming so the Boltzmann probability. So actually, I will recall that the Ising Hamiltonian is a low-order approximation of a Hamiltonian that describes a quite general system of interacting particles, also rapidly moving molecules on lattice gas. We will have a look at this experiment here by Scheidel et al., also from Anton Zeilinger's group. For reasons I will explain you, that's the most advanced dynamic experiment till date. So in short, we are now going to try to construct an explicit Hilbert model for this experiment. I call this a hidden variable toy model for a dynamic Bell experiment. Why is that experiment by Scheidel et al. Of 2010 the most advanced? Well, because it tries to close simultaneously at least two loopholes, namely the locality loophole and the freedom of will loophole. They clearly explain that the locality loophole arises when Alice's measurement result can in principle be causally influenced by a physical signal from Bob's measurement event or Bob's choice event and vice versa. The best available way to close this loophole is to space-like separate every measurement event on one side from both the measurement and setting choice on the other side, okay? And in this way, actually what I try to impose both outcome independence and parameter independence, so essentially by quickly switching the analyzer directions and in other cases by making that the relevant events are simultaneously happening, so they are space-like separated. Now, this is, as far as I know, the only experiment that also tries to close what people call the freedom of choice loophole. And they maintain here that this loophole can only be closed if Alice's and Bob's setting values are chosen by random number generators, and also if the transmission of any physical signal between their choice events and the particle pair emission event is excluded, meaning that these events must be space-like separated. So they claim that in this way you can impose this stochastic independence. Lambda cannot depend on A and B. Well, that's a very complicated experiment. I don't need to tell you that. The essential experimental conditions of the experiment were the following here. I will, go over it very quickly. The measurement events were space-like separated. Also, the left measurement event from the choice of the right angle. The setting choice events were space-like separated. And MI was imposed, according to the authors, by space-like separate the emission event, so lambda, if you like, and the setting choice events A and B. Space-like separation was obtained by fast and random switching of the settings at a frequency of 1 megahertz, and or by the fact that in some reference frame, the events happened simultaneously. Okay, let me now present you the toy model in a nutshell on one slide, and then I will explain in a much more detailed way where these assumptions come from. So the main assumption is that the Bell particles move through a two-dimensional background gas or medium, which, for simplicity, is spread out on a lattice, a very simple lattice, only 10 nodes, it's a toy model. The particles, the analyzers, and the background particles are described by a hidden stochastic property, lambda. So you've got 10 lambdas here characterizing each node. And all these lambda interact via this Hamiltonian. I will explain you where it comes from. Actually, that's simply a Taylor expansion. And the model also assumes that the probability of a given configuration theta is, again, the Boltzmann probability. And I submit this as a simple, and that I would also be happy to discuss with you, that's a realistic model for that. I submit as a simple description of a stochastic background medium. So the idea is to simulate, in a very simple way, the interaction of the Bell particles and analyzers with a medium which is characterized by a stochastic variable lambda. Now let us go in details through this model. Actually, I need to idealize a little bit the real Bell experiment of Scheil et al., because that was an asymmetric experiment. Alice was much closer to the source than Bob in the experiment, so they had to use very complex delay lines to assure space-like separation between relevant events. We can do it simply. We can consider a symmetric case. The source is in the middle. But that's basically the only simplification. Of course, the model itself is very idealized. So for every pair, emission happens at t equal to 0. Measurement occurs at t 0. The two particles leave a source S at a speed close enough to the speed of light, following the dashed trajectories. And Alice and Bob measure the spin sigma 1 and sigma 2 at time t 0, which is the moment the particles arrive at nodes 1 and 2. Of course, these nodes, for instance, 2 and B, they're very close because the particle interacts here with this analyzer, right? I could have drawn this more squeezed, but that doesn't play any role. Exactly as in Scheidel's experiment, Alice and Bob's number generators randomly chose between A and A prime and B prime with a frequency of 1 megahertz. And then you can verify that in this idealized representation, you have exactly the same conditions of space-like separation as in the real experiment.
Sorry, what exactly is going on at those nodes? Are they making measurements?
I'm going to explain the model now in more detail, but to answer your question, here are basically, here's a medium, if you like, particles, which are characterized by a stochastic property, which can only take two values, plus one and minus one. And so it can flip stochastically between these values. The particles come out here. When they arrive here, they will be measured, the spin will be measured by Alice here. And there is, of course, interaction for this measurement. You need an interaction between the particle arriving here and an analyzer, which is located at node A and which has an analyzer angle A. Okay, but I will explain it in more detail. So the essential hypothesis is that I think that some people have already understood why we are going to construct this. Of course, we want to come back to the spin dynamics, which we already know. Yeah? But let me explain how I think we can get there. The essential hypothesis is that the Bell particles and analyzers interact with a background field or background medium characterized by hidden variables lambda. For definiteness, we'll suppose that the particles are let out on a 2D lattice and a very simple one, as you can see. More specifically, at nodes 3 to 8 of the lattice sit particles that are characterized by these properties lambda 3 to lambda 8, which are stochastic parameters. And we assume again that they can only take the values plus 1 and minus 1. Therefore, we could, of course, call these lambda generalized spins. Okay. Now, particles 1 and 2, they are, in a Bell experiment, of course, characterized by their spins. But we assume now, we are constructing a hidden variable toy model, that they are also characterized by lambda 1 and lambda 2. And in the most simple way, the spin is simply equal to the hidden property. Similarly, the analyzers, they are characterized by their angles, but also by lambda A and lambda B in a simple way. So if Alice puts her analyzer on the angle A, lambda A simply takes that value that A has. Okay? I will suppose that A and B only have the values plus 1 and minus 1. That's enough to verify the Bell inequality. And so all the properties, they take only the value plus and minus 1. H3 is maybe a little bit more subtle. I call this the hypothesis of determinism. What I mean by that is that all the lambda I interact via a Hamiltonian, which I will specify, with close neighbors only. I will suppose they interact now with first and second neighbors. When the Bell particles move through the 2D lattice, they interact with the background medium and the analyzers. Of course, this can give rise to a hugely complex Hamiltonian. And this Hamiltonian will, in general, not only depend on these generalized spin degrees of freedom, but also on other degrees of freedom, for instance, the velocity vectors of particles 1 and 2. I suppose now that these degrees of freedom are deterministic over the ensemble. That means, in particular, that at the time of measurement, T0, all these other degrees of freedom, they have the same value over the ensemble. So the spin vector, the velocity vector of the first particle has a given value for all pairs, so over the whole ensemble. And the ensemble probability for a configuration theta is again the Boltzmann probability.
H2, yes. The particles 1 and 2, you say that they basically coincide with the hidden variables lambda 1 and lambda 2. Is that on account of where they've ended up, or did they coincide right from the start? Am I meant to picture these lambdas on a lattice and the particles have reached those
lattice? Well, at least they should be equal at the time of measurement, but let us say that they're always even during that time evolution, they remain equal. Okay, you can make a more fancy relationship between lambda and sigma. What is important is that you have this, because we're going to calculate this, and we need to know this to verify the Bell inequality. So this simple relationship is enough to be able to calculate what we need. Okay, but that's not an essential thing.
So the function of these 3 to 8 are to set up some stochastic background with hidden variables.
Exactly.
Why does it matter they're on a lattice? Why couldn't you just say they're someplace?
I agree with you. I don't think it's necessary but it made things much easier to calculate.
Well, I guess just the fact that you put them on a lattice suggests to me that their spatial configuration relative to the particles in the Bell experiment matters, but I guess since they're hidden variables, I don't see why it does. All we need is some background of hidden variables someplace to interact with everything else, right?
I agree.
Okay.
Yes. So, of course, we've chosen the assumptions to drastically simplify a description of a potentially very complex system. Now, even without making any of these assumptions, a given Hamiltonian, which is a function of n spin, so-called spin degrees of freedom, can, of course, be written here as a Taylor expansion. That's a Taylor expansion. Here you recognize actually the shape of the Ising Hamiltonian, okay, the second and the third term. You can forget about the constant term there. And what I now also will do is to interpret these parameters C, P dot. P is the degree of the Taylor expansion. So these are the C2 dot parameters. These are the C3 dot parameters. I will interpret these as interaction parameters, as it is, for instance, done in the Ising Hamiltonian, where the C2 dot are or the C2 IG or the GIJ of the Ising lattice, interaction constants which are mediated by the Coulomb potential. And in the lattice gas Hamiltonian, these interaction constants, they come about through a Leonard-Jones potential. So in such a lattice gas Hamiltonian, lambda I and lambda j are the occupation numbers, which can be 0 or 1. Okay, but formally, these all have the same shape, and these parameters are interpreted as the interaction parameters. So in this model here, I will take the Cp dot equal to 0 beyond, say, second neighbor interaction. Now, it seems to me that that is all we need, because what we want is to calculate that. We know already, by assumption, that is equal, that we can write it as a function of only the lambda. Now, so that means that we can use the Boltzmann probability, for which we need the Hamiltonian taken at t0, but as said, this Hamiltonian will in general depend on other than spin degrees of freedom, but these are absorbed in the spin dependent factors, the Cp dot of 10. But by the assumption of determinism, in particular t0, these factors have identical values for the whole ensemble. Thus, we end up with a standard Ising type problem, except that Hamiltonian includes higher order terms, and the Cp dot are the parameters of the model. Or put differently, I need this third assumption of determinism in order to be able to calculate what is p theta. I need p theta for that. And if I make this assumption of determinism, then basically what you have in this denominator, z, you have a series of terms of which the parameters are all the same over the whole lattice, which is exactly the same thing as happens in an Ising lattice. So you can use the same numerical methods as in a regular Ising system. So the 16 probabilities needed to test the Bell inequality can be calculated now in the same way. These expressions are the same as these here. I don't know why I put that, it's obvious, which now follows in exactly the same way as in a classical Ising system by the formulas which I already showed you. And as I think is not a surprise anymore, we find, of course, for we can go to fourth order. We do not have to stay until second order. I went to fourth order. And the Bell inequality is again violated for wide ranges of all the constants in the Hamiltonian. The resource is again measurement dependence, violation of MI. For instance, you can go to a value of 2.82. And at the same time, we find that outcome independence and parameter independence are always valid. The system is local in the sense of Clauser-Horn, as expected, because we only introduced actually local interactions between these first and second neighbors. Okay, but it's still nice to verify that always OI and PI, so the factorability, is satisfied. Now, if you would, in these interaction constants, if you would introduce an interaction between, for instance, 1 and 2, or between 1 and B, which is a non-local effect, then your Clauser-Horn condition is not satisfied anymore. So I think, but we should discuss that, because that would be very surprising, that MI is violated in this type of models without relying on superdeterminism or conspiracy. Alice and Bob can freely choose A and B. I believe that measurement dependence can arise simply through ordinary Coulomb interaction, even if A and B are perfectly freely chosen. One usually assumes that this violates free will in a non-superdeterministic world, because measurement dependence would mean that the freely or randomly chosen parameters AB are causally determined by the variables lambda. However, I believe that this is not correct. You can have stochastic dependence without causal determination. So that means that you have in these models also that, of course, by inversion, by Bayes rule, that also the probability of AB given lambda is not the same if you fix another lambda value, even if A and B are perfectly freely chosen. Okay, that looks at first sight a bit counterintuitive, because you would think, well, these are freely chosen. Still, I believe that one should not understand this as a manifestation of a causal determination of the freely chosen A and B by lambda. It's just a correlation. And actually, I think that there are many other systems like that. For instance, think of the experiment where you measure several half-lives of a nucleus as a function of a set of discrete temperatures T. The probability of having a given half-life for the nucleus given a temperature, well, depends, of course, on the temperature. And at the same time, you have then that the probability, if you sample, let's say, three or four temperatures, in this series, the probability of a given temperature depends on X, is correlated with X, even if your T is perfectly freely chosen.
The analogy confuses me more than the original example. But let me ask a few questions about the original example. So first of all, in your model, you have 10 sites. So you have 10 different lambdas, lambda 1 through lambda 10. Over here, you have a general lambda without a subscript. How does that lambda relate to the other 10 lambdas?
Lambda, I defined it as actually the set of six lambdas, lambda 3, sigma lambda, sigma lambda, sigma 3 till sigma 8. So this lambda here are Actually, you have more freedom. It's one of these, or a subset of the set of these six.
Any subset.
Yeah, any subset.
So let's assume we take all six.
Yes.
So
exactly.
If Alice chooses her setting to be given by lambda equals plus one, say, and Bob chooses his setting to be given by lambda equals minus one, then doesn't
that mean with sigma a?
So he chooses, because you say they could choose. Doesn't that mean that the probability is the probability of having that setting at side A and side B, so the probability of having minus one plus one is just equal to one, independent of the values of the other, of the central six lambdas?
Well, but still, so you can calculate.
But just by fiat, they say Alice sets the probability to be to one, for the setting minus one. Bob, by fiat, sets the probability equal to one for having setting plus one. So therefore, the joint probability of having minus one plus one is one. All the others must be zero.
I absolutely agree.
So in that case, independent of what the six central lambdas are equal to, you would have an equality here, lambda probability of...
Well, I fully agree that the unconditional probability would be one for this experiment.
And the conditional probability.
Not the conditional probability. You can select out of that whole set. Maybe if you only look at that seems to be true. Yeah. If you really fix for the whole series A and B, then I guess that it's always independent of true. So this then must be the case where the system evolves on its own. Yeah. Or where let's say you have an experiment where A and B can have two values each. Well, this is a very subtle point. Interpretation of probability is a difficult topic, and since this is, I guess, a surprising result, we should think about it very clearly. I'll come back on it later. So if this is correct, we have a toy model for real Bell experiments that violates the Bell inequality and is local and non-conspiratorial, and the resource is violation of MI. As far as I know, but this is, I think, the real criterion to judge this toy model is, are we doing physics here? Is this a real physical model? Obviously, it is still a toy model because it does not yet predict the cosine of the quantum correlation. And a more physical model would consider an infinite lattice because that simulates a field. So I submit the present results as a first step in a wider program. An intermediate conclusion seems to be that MI is not a generally valid condition in all local systems, at least not in all background-based systems. What I would like to do now is to, I think I can show this in a much more general way than only by referring to the Ising model or the Ising-like model. More broadly, so we are now at the last chapter of this little presentation. We are now going to see if we can find arguments for the construction of a realistic subquantum theory. And actually, I'm going to present you a research outline here. But first, let us try to generalize already this model. These were the essential assumptions of the model, right? So. Now, they clearly presuppose that spin lattices in the ensemble are in a thermal equilibrium with a heat bath at 1 over b. That is certainly needed to use the Boltzmann probability rule. I think actually you can relax it here because if you would consider energy states where the temperature differs, you still will violate the Bell inequality. So I think that this might be relaxed, but I'm not sure about it. Another kind of equilibrium that is needed in the system, that is causal equilibrium between nearest neighbors or near neighbors, okay? I think that such a Hamiltonian also presupposes, obviously, that there is an interaction between at least near neighbors. Okay, and now maybe I'm going to try to answer your point, Lucien. For instance, in a lattice gas Hamiltonian, even if the particles are moving very fast, there is a Lennard-Jones potential between near neighbors. In order to have causal contact between near neighbors, it is essential for the model that the switching frequency of the analyzers is not much bigger than the 1 megahertz that is used in the experiment of Scheidel et al. 1 megahertz, that means that the analyzers here, they remain in their position for, on average, 1 microsecond. That corresponds to a causal range of 300 meters. That means that for the model to be applicable, these near neighbors must be closer than this 300 meters. Now, let me go over it once more. In the model, the interaction between the analyzers and their environment, for instance, between lambda A and lambda 6, are mediated by a possibly hidden force potential. The switching should therefore be slow enough so that causal contact with near neighbors can be established. In the experiment we are looking at, Scheidel et al., the settings remain constant for a duration of 1 microsecond, corresponding to 300 meters. Therefore, if the first neighbors of nodes A and B, namely nodes 6 and A, are positioned closer than R, lambda A and lambda 6 are time-light separated. Also, between all other near neighbor nodes, there is some causal contact at the time of measurement. So it seems to me that we can apply our Ising type or lattice gas type Hamiltonian. Now, this seems to be a crucial point because it shows that measurement independence can be violated in these background-based models independently of the form of the Hamiltonian. If 5 minutes, then we'll have to go real fast. Well, actually, it's very trivial, especially if you look at it in a field vocabulary. This is the background field or medium. You describe it in a neighborhood of your analyzers. You describe it by a set of hidden variables, lambda 1. Okay? Obviously, this analyzer can interact with the medium in its neighborhood, and that is enough to create a stochastic dependence. Okay? By the way, this medium also interacts with the particles. So as I said, since lambda 1 can interact with A, that's enough. It seems to me, and I think it is a very obvious consequence of the definition of a conditional probability, that MI can be violated. Actually, this mechanism has been conjectured by Jeremy Butterfield already. And my conclusion is then that an experiment as the one of Scheidel et al. May separate left and right wings, but not the analyzers from their nearby environment. I've told you in the beginning something about these sub-quantum theories, which are all based on a stochastic zero-point field or vacuum field. I conjecture that this might be a very simple version of such sub-quantum theories, which all claim to reproduce some aspects of quantum mechanics, but as far as I know, it has not yet been shown that they can bypass Bell's theorem. Now, we are not yet, of course, at the point that we have a realistic sub-quantum theory. I conjecture that if you want to reproduce the cosine of the singlet state, then you also have to violate not only mi, but also oi. But there's one essentially ingredient that the model has not yet exploited, namely that sigma 1 and sigma 2 are connected by a symmetry, total spin is conserved. And I think that if you, it seems to me that if you take that into account, that actually oi is a very, which people always consider to be an almost, well, a rather obvious consequence of locality, but actually, why would your left spin be independent of the second spin if they were, if they are connected by symmetry, by conservation of total spin? And people have already observed this, that there is nothing obvious in assuming that even in a local system, OI is valid. So the next step would be to include this symmetry into the model, and then we can look at what happens for an infinity of lattice nodes, which is a physically more convincing configuration. My last point will then be that if this model is sound, then it would allow, it seems, to test, this model can be tested. Because suppose there is a background, if the polarization direction is switched rapidly enough in the time interval 0, T0, then it seems very straightforward that your lambda medium will at most experience a smeared out or averaged influence from the analyzer settings. Okay? That is how Bell came to the idea already in his first article to switch quickly the analyzer settings. In other words, rho lambda may depend on the four settings, but not on just AB, but that is equivalent to a measurement independence. The same distribution for lambda applies to the four sub-ensembles. And then in that case, obviously, you can again derive the Bell inequality. All premises of the Bell inequality are satisfied. Now, such a deep coupling of the analyzer from the environment can be simulated in the model by letting the interaction constant Cp dot between A and its neighbors and B and its neighbors tend to zero. So you simply multiply the interaction constants in your model by a coupling constant epsilon, which goes from 0 to 1. You do the same thing. You multiply with the same epsilon all the interaction constants involving B. And what you then get is the following. So these two figures only differ in different parameters. So let's simply look at the left one. I calculate here XBI and MD, degree of violation of MI, as a function of this coupling constant epsilon. So epsilon 1 means all the interaction constants have a static value. When epsilon is 0, this would correspond to a very high frequency. Okay, then you will satisfy again MI simply because the lambda only experience an average influence from A and A prime and B and B prime. So what you get is that for the static case of epsilon equal to 1, as I showed you already before, you can get very high values in the model for XBI. Okay? But when you decrease epsilon, or in other words, increase the switching frequency, they should, and they do in the model, fall just under 2 here. At that moment, your MD is exactly 0, as you expect. And so this would be a means to distinguish such this model. And I think, in general, any background-based models, because this averaging out seems to me to hold for all background-based models. It's, of course, it's difficult to estimate when this decoupling would happen. But if you assume that that the coupling breaks down when the causal range becomes of the order of the typical length of the polarizer, say about 10 centimeters, then you find a decoupling frequency of the order of a few gigahertz. to be compared with the 1 megahertz that is used now. And according to Gregor Weiss, who is one of the experimenters doing these experiments, that's a very complex experiment, but it can in principle be done. My last slide. So I presented a toy model that is local, I believe also non-superdeterministic, and it violates the BI. Resource is violation of MI. As far as I know, the model does not contradict physical principles, but please let us discuss it. And it allows an interpretation in terms of a background medium. And it's quite obvious, I think, to understand that assuming a background medium, MI can be violated also beyond the specific Hamiltonian of the toy model. So what these results suggest is that we might reconsider a shift in the meaning of the hidden variables, not consider them as a property of the particles, as people always do, but of the background medium. And then MI, I believe, is not a reasonable premise. Of course, we are now a little bit departed from Bell's original hypothesis, where he looks at the deterministic case. So I believe there is an incentive to look for these background-based models, and maybe they can be tested. That's all what I would like to present.
Most is that you use these probabilities that are derived from a Boltzmann probabilities, and those would clearly be okay under appropriate assumptions that the system has had time to formalize. Mm. But it seems that time would have to be bigger than sort of L over C, where L is the size of your system. But if the system is allowed to evolve by itself for time greater than L over C, then you know, once you've chosen the settings, then there's a perfectly local, reasonable explanation as to why a setting choice over here can influence what happens over here. There's nothing especially surprising about that.
Yes.
And that would be a way of violating MI, because the hidden variables are allowed to be influenced as the system formalizes by the settings. So that's my in terms of the importance of the variables, that's my biggest concern.
Well, that's a very serious concern. That's, of course, an excellent question. Why could we not imagine that the whole ensemble is always in thermal equilibrium, with an external heat bath? Do you really think that changing the spin of one of these particles would bring the system out of thermal equilibrium? As far as I know, but I'm not an expert, the thermal degrees of freedom, or actually the degrees of freedom which are influenced by temperature, do not include spin.
Simple counterintuitive, you have, rather than 10 particles, you have just one particle. You have some Hamiltonian that will induce a Boltzmann distribution. But now you just select, you say, well, no, I'm going to prepare it in a definite state. You know, lambda equals minus one. Okay. So the probability of lambda equals minus one is one, probability of lambda equals plus one is zero. And that's a probability distribution which is different from the Boltzmann distribution. So there's an example where making a choice of choosing the lambdas by hand can violate. So if you have a more complicated situation with 10 rather than just one, where you only choose two rather than all 10, but still, I think my simple counterexample is reason enough to be concerned.
The question is then, can you really with a system which has one particle, still apply Boltzmann's...
I was just generating a counterexample. How about, here's no counterexample, take 10 particles, select all of them in the lambda equals minus one state. Okay, well, that will not be a Boltzmann distribution either. So suddenly intervening on the values of these hidden variables can take you away from a Boltzmann distribution. So whether intervening on just two, also is in my opinion, it's quite likely, but it's a matter of calculation, not speculation.
Might be a good. It seems a very good point. Yeah, should be seriously thought about. Yeah.
Well, just you have to do the calculation,
I guess.
So this may be just making Lucien's point in a different way, but I was wondering about that. There are all these results in condensed matter systems, spin systems, about finite speed of information propagation, like Lee-Robertson bound. And if you looked at the classical case of that, doesn't that say exactly the kind of thing that Lucien's saying, that if I make a change over here, if I impose that this spin has a certain direction, then there's a finite speed at which that information can propagate to the other side. So why doesn't that show that it would take, you know, the speed of light times, you know, the length of...
Sorry?
So why doesn't that show that this information would only propagate at the speed of light? So if you change the analyzer settings over here, it wouldn't have an effect on the other side quickly enough.
Well, to avoid such a left-right interaction, people like Scheidel, well, the group of Anton Zeilinger, what they do is they quickly change the spin. Okay. And they measure basically before the signal has time to reach the other side. That's what I tried to reproduce in this experiment here. So the point is that, sure, this frequency is high enough to decouple left and right side, but not the sides and their near environment.
Yeah, but that's why I'm invoking Lee-Robertson here, because it's...
Who?
The Lee-Robertson bound. So it shows that there's a finite speed of information propagation in a spin lattice, for example.
Do they speak about...
This is generally for the quantum case, but you could consider the classical special case of this. So if I take... I mean, there are many versions of this, and I'm not a world expert on it by any means, but if you take a spin lattice and you, for example, change one of the states of the spin, then there'll be a finite propagation. There'll be a finite speed at which that information will be able to propagate across the lattice.
Well, that's obvious. No?
Well, it requires quite a heavy proof. But the point is that the further, so there should be a factor which includes how far away the two. So it's not that providing you've given this thing enough time to interact with its nearest neighbor, that suddenly the information will be available at the other side of the lattice.
But that's not what I assume at all. I don't need to assume that the information went to the other side.
What I'm saying is that you're implicitly assuming that because you're using the Boltzmann distribution, which kind of is allowed, which is assuming the system is thermalized, and so it's assuming that you have time for that to happen.
Well, I really don't know. I'm very... I fully agree that the frozen system needs to be in thermal equilibrium, but the whole question is changing some property, a stochastic property, call it spin, but in this hidden variable model, it can be any stochastic property. Does that affect, yes or no, the thermal equilibrium of the system? If it is a degree of freedom which is not affected by, if it is a degree of freedom which does not, like for instance, the speed of the particles intervene in the thermal exchange, is that can that really be excluded?
I think it's simple to here's another counterexample. Here's an actual counterexample to what you assume. I'm sort of thinking about it a bit more. So if you assume that your 10 particles have a probability distribution which is thermally distributed, then in there will be a non-zero probability for the case where particles, is it 1 in 10, the ones that you said? So 1 in 10?
1 and 2 are the spins, and the A and B are the control parameters.
Okay, so A and B. So the possible is A and B. Let's assume the so we have, consider the probability of getting A equals plus 1, B equals plus 1, and then say plus 1, like 1, plus 1. The probability of plus 1.
Can you write it down?
Sure.
Yeah, because
so you have 10 parameters, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Let's assume that each of these, let's just consider the probability, each of these is plus 1.
Yes.
Okay. Now, in according to the Boltzmann probability, there'll be some, this will be non-zero.
Yes.
In general. However, I can set that P of A equals minus 1 and P equals minus 1. So therefore, the Yauch probability will have to be this B equal to 0. So the Boltzmann probability, the actual probability. And so there's an example where intervening can change.
I don't agree. And the reason is the following. You're doing two different experiments.
Probabilities are always linked to precise experiments. So in the first one, you let the system evolve on its own.
Right.
And in the second one, you intervene.
Right.
Not necessarily the probabilities are equal. You have to calculate it.
No, but his probabilities are not equal to the ones that you would get from the Boltzmann distribution. In the case where you intervened, that was the thing that was the discussion. So one cannot assume under intervention that your probabilities are distributed according to Boltzmann. I think the selling point of what you've done is to show that under relaxation, you know, that actually you can quite naturally get a violation of Bell inequalities. This is a very natural physical system, and as long as you allow your system time to thermalize, then you quite naturally get a violation. But the sort of situation that's of interest is where the settings are made space-like separated from everything else, and then one shouldn't assume that the thermal system is thermalized.
We should look at it in more detail, because I know by experience that these calculations of probabilities are extremely subtle. If this is correct, then there are many examples of cases where experts calculated probabilities and in the end it's wrong. I still think that the real question is: is it a physical assumption that you assume a Boltzmann probability distribution, even if you intervene on two properties? I surely propose that we look at it in detail. It might absolutely be true. It's so. Yes.
But it's not super deterministic. So my question is, what's the definition of super determinism that you're using when you say it's not super deterministic?
The definition of super determinism is that there are common causes between
the values of your lambda and the values of your angles, so your analyzer angles. So super determinism means that
there was superdeterminism. Isn't that between lambda and the settings?
That's between lambda and settings, that there are common causes to that.
So, I mean, that will influence the condition probability.
Yes, true.
So I'm just saying that, I mean, for me, the working definition of superdeterminism is that measurement independence holds. So, I mean, if measurement independence doesn't hold, then there is superdeterminism. Mm. What do you mean when you say there's no superdeterminism?
I mean by that that MD, measurement dependence, is not at all in disagreement with free will. So even if...
What's your notion, what's your definition of free will? I mean, I need a precise definition to make that distinction. So far it's just been a definition.
Basically, here they can set A and B in whatever frequency. They can choose the sequence of A and B with whatever in whatever sequence they want, with whatever frequency. Always you find violation of MI. And actually, the reason why MI is violated in this model is, it seems to me, simply due to Coulomb interaction or any physical interaction between the analyzers and the hidden variables close in that neighborhood. Okay? Actually, it seems to me rather obvious that...
Oh, you mean it's because of direct interaction? Between
yes, them? Yes. Not because of common causes who would determine both.
Do I recall that in the first toy model, there was a violation beyond the Searlson bound?
Yes.
Yes. Can one obtain that in the second model by a specific choice of parameters?
Yes.
Therefore, my question is, why refer to these theories as subquantum?
This is my goal to start investigating them was to try to see if such subquantum theories is possible. So there are a whole bunch of people who have been trying to produce what I call subquantum theories, and which are based on a stochastic background medium. So this spin lattice can be maybe considered to be a simple version of such a stochastic background field. And that's why I call them like that.
I think maybe super quantum.
Sub super.
Are you working in this field of quantum information theory where, for instance, the people use non-local PR boxes and where they wonder whether such systems can really exist?
Sure. I think the confusion, I don't know if you know this, but some people call those correlations superquantum correlations. The PBR box would be called superquantum correlations. So you're talking about a subquantum theory that produces superquantum correlations. That's exactly the point. Yeah.
We can discuss in detail with pleasure.
That's
parameter independence. No, parameter independence is, I can show you. Parameter independence is that your, for instance, your left spin would depend on your right analyzer angle. Okay.
Any other questions? Okay.